This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Welcome to Desert Island Discs, where every week I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, the book and the luxury item that they'd want to take with them if they were cast away on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music on these podcast versions is shorter than in the original broadcast. You can find over 2,000 more editions to listen to and download on the Desert Island Discs website. My castaway today is the writer Pam Ayres. She is an unusual poet. She sells a lot of books. And she smiles as she declaims witty, charming, wily verse on everything from dry stone walling to dodgy vending machines, capturing the daily confusions, niceties and frustrations of what it means to be English. She became a big star in the 1970s, winning the votes and hearts of millions of viewers with her distinctive delivery and cheeky grin. That newfound nationwide fame and the giddy whiz of showbiz must surely have come as something of a shock. Up until then, she'd spent her time in the civil service and the RAF. She says, "I'm not saying that what I do is easy. It's very hard. It's just I never felt like a poet proper because my goals are different. I don't want to provoke thought or be profound. I just want to make my audience feel at home and give them a laugh." Welcome, Pam Ayres. Do you agree with what you said?
Well, sort of, yeah. Certainly I never set out to be a poet. I didn't really listen to poetry. I wasn't from that sort of a home. Nobody stood around declaiming poetry at each other. And certainly from my point of view, in our home, I'm the youngest child of 6 children. We were brought up in a council house, and there's nothing wrong with that. But poetry was roundly ridiculed in our house. We didn't have any book-filled libraries or anything like that. Everybody was concerned with making a living. I liked writing. I liked the idea of making people laugh, and I loved performing, and I just knit them all together.
I hinted in the, or more than hinted in the introduction there, that you're unusual as a poet in that you've made your life, you've actually managed to make a living at it. And very few poets do that. You know, often they'll be sort of professors of English, or they'll have a different writing career that runs in conjunction. What would you say has been fundamental to your success?
Well, I'm clearly not in that category, am I? I'm not a scholarly poet at all. I think I've got the common touch. I write about things that I hope people will identify with. Some of my most successful poems, for instance, "They Should Have Asked My Husband," is about the husband who knows it all and it doesn't matter what you talk about, he's going to come in and monopolise the conversation. And I'm not saying my husband's like that, because he's not. But everybody knows somebody like that. And I search for those subjects. There's always a temptation to think that because something looks simple and it goes ta-tum, 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 that it's easy. But actually it isn't, because you've got to find the right word that says exactly what you want to convey, and you've got to get the stress on the right syllable. And I find it like a fascinating jigsaw to put it together. And the best thing is to get a big laugh at the end. And that's the most difficult thing, because you don't want it to peter out. You want it to have a, you know, finish with a big bang at the end.
Tell me about your first piece of music, Pam Ayres.
My first piece of music is called "Only Remembered" from Warhorse, and I've got various feelings about this. One is the magic of theatre. One is my love of folk music. One is my happy memories of working with the Albion Band in the 80s. This is a traditional folk song which has been adapted and tinkered with. It also reminds me of the several times I've been to see Warhorse. It's just magic, and it summarises the beauty and glory of theatre when it's done well. What you can do with a few sticks and a bit of wicker work.
Fading away like the stars in the morning, losing their light in the glorious sun. Thus would we pass from this earth and its toiling, only remembered for what we have done. Only remembered, only remembered.
Only remembered from Warhorse, performed there by John Tams and members of the Warhorse Company Chorus. It was composed by Shankey and Bonner and arranged by Tams and Hoff. Pamirs, you're at a time now in your life, you've been writing for so many decades, that you have a canon, if you will, a body of work. I'm guessing that when you go to perform, as you often do, live performance, that people want the greatest hits. I mean, do you have a My Way? Do you have something that you think, I'm going to have to do this, and yes, I don't really want to do it?
No, well, it's I wish I looked after me teeth.
Ah, of course it is, yes.
I try not to look tired of it. I'm not tired of it. I'm grateful to it, really, because it kind of put me on the map. And I always try and do a good job of it. But I know people are disappointed if I don't do I Wish I Looked After My Teeth. And there's always a nice round of applause when I start saying it. And I can team it with other things. I've recently written a poem called Don't Put Me Dinner on the Slate, which is about the trend in pubs to always put your grub on a slate or a breadboard or something. But I know people like it. And they have family associations with it. They remember listening to it and laughing with their granny or their parents. And so I try and give it as good a performance as I can.
Alongside all of that humour that you bring with your work, there's great tenderness in some of your work. And I'm thinking now of something like Woodland Burial, you know, appreciated by so many people and read very often, I imagine, at very, very many funeral services. In writing that, did you have an aim for it to be a public bit of work that would be used a lot? I mean, what was the thinking behind it?
Woodland Burial is a short poem I wrote after I walked through the church in the village near where I used to live called Preston. And it was a January day and it was grey and the churchyard was in the shadow of the church and the gravestones were all leaning over at drunken angles. And I thought, I don't want to go here. It's dead, you know, in all sorts of ways. I thought I'd rather go into a forest where something gorgeous can grow out of what used to be me. I'm a great believer in compost heaps. And I thought it would be nice if the bits and pieces that made my body were utilised by something as gorgeous as a tree, and birds would live in it and insects and things would make use of it. And I agonised over whether to put it in my book because it is so serious. It's about death. I was astounded, really, and delighted with the response because so many natural burial grounds approached me and said, do you mind if we use this, you know, put it on the wall? And I've been to lots of natural burial grounds where they've got it inscribed on plaques on the wall, and that's a very nice feeling.
Let's have some more music, Pamirs. We're going to hear your second of the day. Tell me a little bit about this.
This is Master of the House from Les Miserables, and it's sung by Alan Armstrong. And I love it because the words are so clever. And I shall always remember Alan Armstrong in Les Mis and his lovely sneering voice. And he's the master of the inn and he's ripping everybody off. And you see people come in with their suitcases and the suitcases are whisked away. And you know the poor traveller is never going to see them again. And then on comes Alan Armstrong, singing this wonderful sneering song.
Master of the house, keeper of the zoo, ready to relieve a mother Sue or two. Watering the wine, making up the weight, picking up their knickknacks when they can't see straight. Everybody loves a landlord, everybody's bosom friend. I'll do whatever pleases Jesus, damn, I'll bleed him in the end.
Master of the House from Les Miserables, performed there by Alan Armstrong and members of the original 1985 London cast. It was composed by Alain Boublil, Claude-Michel Schoenberg and Herbert Kretzmer. I'm sorry that we cut that short because you were thoroughly enjoying it, Pamirs.
I was rocking over here.
You were born, you mentioned this, the youngest of six children in what was then Berkshire, is now Oxfordshire, 1947. Tell me a little bit about your family background.
My dad was in the Grenadier Guards. He signed up, he lied about his age and joined up. I admired him. I think he was very traumatised by what he'd seen. He had bad temper explosions, which scared us all. But I understand it now.
Right.
I understand the terrible things he saw. I don't think you just get over it and walk away. When Dad came out of the army, he went to work for the Southern Electricity Board as a linesman. He used to shin up the poles and fiddle with the wires at the top. My mum was a very bright girl. She was offered a scholarship, but her mother was widowed, so her mother used to take in washing, and she died of TB. So they really had a terrible life of poverty, but they were very loving. And she went into domestic service in Cromwell Road in London. She was offered a scholarship to a grammar school, but she couldn't take it up because they couldn't afford whatever you had to buy, the uniform or something. But she was bright. She loved English. She could always advise me on the right word to use or if I didn't know what a word meant.
And she went to work in service then, you say, in Cromwell Road in London, a very, very different place from Balking, I imagine. Mm. What did she make of it?
She didn't like having to be so servile. She said I had to wear a little lat and a pinny and I had to curtsy to him. She was demeaned by it, as you would be, wouldn't you?
So as you were growing up, what are your strongest memories of your mum?
Well, she never had much time for us, which wasn't her fault. She had six children to look after. When I think about it now, her life was drudgery. My dad had a vast allotment and he used to come home with small tin baths full of massive quantities of food, and we'd sit out on the back step and we'd shell the beans and shell the peas and peel the spud. She used to prepare enormous quantities of food, and then she had the washing to do, and she used to say I didn't know which way to turn. She said I never had time for any of you. And I think it was a great regret, because she was a loving mum, but she was exhausted.
Some more music, Pam Ears. We're going to hear your third. Tell me about this one.
This is Bob Dylan. I discovered him when I was 17 years old. And for the first time in my life, I felt as though it was music and songwriting which was relevant to me. This is times they are changing. And my dad was quite authoritarian. You'd say, I'd like to go to the dance in Wantage, Dad. Forget it. You know, it wasn't any discussion, he'd say. Then I listened to Bob Dylan, Times They Are A-Changin', on my LP, and I'll just read you the words that really spoke to me. It says, come mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticise what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. So get out of the way if you can't help. You know, and that really spoke to me. So I felt as though he was talking to me. We were a similar age. And also because I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't know how to express it. He made me feel that I wanted to write my own things. I didn't ever want to write like Bob Dylan. I wanted to write my own things, and he accentuated that feeling.
And mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticise what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times they are a-changing.
That was Bob Dylan and The Times They Are Changing. I wonder, Pam Ears, for you in the 60s, you know, you weren't in Hay Ashbury, you weren't even in the King's Road, you know, you were in rural Berkshire. How much were the times a-changing?
Not much, you know, the old attitudes lingered in the villages.
And your father, you know, typical of his generation and certainly his own experiences, a military man who was pretty strict and didn't put up with much, and you said he had these rages. Did you want to do things that he wouldn't allow you to do?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to paint a black picture of my dad. I loved him dearly. He was funny. He was strong. He looked after us. He grew all these vegetables that, you know, we're all still going strong. And I think that they laid a foundation of good health for us at a time when nothing was known about what was a good diet. But we had loads of rabbit and loads of vegetables and loads of fruit. So I loved him dearly. He was funny, but he did have these extraordinary rages. And I know I had a boyfriend I was absolutely nuts about. And one night he brought me home in his car at 10:30 or something. He brought me home from the dance. And I heard the window clang open of my dad's bedroom. And he bawled out. He said, Pam, is that you? And I wound the window down. I said, yeah. And he said, well, bloody well, come on in then. And I was so shamed, and I got out of the car and slunk indoors. And that was the moment when I decided I was going to leave home.
Lots to talk about, but for now we want to hear some more of your choices, Pam Ayres. Tell me about this.
Well, I joined the Women's Royal Air Force because I didn't have any money. I wanted to travel. I was a bit oppressed by my dad's rules. And I joined up when I was 18. And I went to RAF Spitalgate. I put my suitcase down with all the other girls, and this corporal came in and said, "Put your stuff down and get outside." And they were horrible to us for the first couple of weeks, which I think is what they intend to do. And then you began to get little treats. There was a bus trip to Lincoln and a bus trip to Nottingham. And then we were able to go to the Naffy, which was a coffee bar, and we could go and have coffee and stand around the jukebox. And over and over and over again, they played this song.
That was Neil Sedaka and Happy Birthday, Sweet 16. I just did ask you there a second ago, Pam Ayres, if you were a jiver. I was sort of imagining you in a frothy skirt with your coffee on the formica, jiving to that, but apparently not.
No, I dance like a Suffolk Punch, really.
That's a horse, in case anybody's under any illusions.
A large cart horse with hairy feet.
So when you went into the RAF, apart from that complete culture shock of for the first little while being treated not too kindly, as you say, that's part of the process of knocking you into shape. How did it suit you in general?
The great glorious thing from my point of view about the Air Force was that it gave you the opportunities to perform. There were all kinds of opportunities to get on a stage, whether it was a choir or an amateur dramatic group or a folk club, you know, and I was longing to be a performer. I was very unpolished, but I knew where I wanted to be. I was at RAF Brampton, and I'd gone along with a boyfriend to watch a rehearsal, and the girl who was playing the lead hadn't turned up. And they asked me if I'd read in. And I read in and they all said, "Oh, my God, what a marvellous accent." And then the girl dropped out completely. And I stepped in at 10 days notice and I took on the part and I learned it. And everybody was thrilled. And I, at the end of the performance, the squadron leader, it was like God, got up on the stage and said, "I'd like you all to know that Ayres has stood in at 10 days' notice and learned the entire thing. And I do give him a hearty round of applause." And the next morning, I was summoned to the group captain's office, who was the CEO of the whole place. And he said, "I've never laughed so much in all my life." And he said, "What are your ambitions in the Air Force?" And I said, "I want to go to Singapore. I want to go to the Far East." And within weeks, I was posted. So it could have been a coincidence, but I don't know. Perhaps he put in a good word for me. And I used to work with this man and he'd been posted to Singapore. And he used to say, "Oh, God, that's living. You get out there, that's living. This is just existing."
Tell me about this next one. We are on your fifth.
This is Bruce Springsteen, Independence Day. I love Bruce Springsteen. I love this song because it underlines that point at which you separate from the oppressive parent. I'm not saying my parents were oppressive. I seem to keep banging on about this, but it just underlines the fact that if you are in a situation in a family where you're being kept under, it doesn't last forever because the old fall away. That's what he describes here so beautifully. Also, I wrote a poem about Bruce Springsteen, which stood me in such good stead for years. It had lines in it which I was really pleased with. It's called "Do You Think Bruce Springsteen Would Fancy Me?" And it's about being much too old for him to fancy you, but you're kidding yourself. And, well, a couple of the lines were, of course, "Bruce is used to admiration. He's idolised in every nation. He's cheered and clapped in every state. Me, I'm clapped at our past eight." And this is his lovely song about breaking away. "'Cause the darkness of this house has got the best of us. There's a darkness in this town that's got us too. But they can't touch me now, and you can't touch me now.
they ain't gonna do to me what I watch them do to you. So say goodbye, it's Independence Day. It's Independence Day all down the
That was Bruce Springsteen and Independence Day. You made me laugh there, Pam Ayres, with your Bruce Springsteen poem and the thing about...
I had a terribly disappointing experience. I was in Australia working and my younger son, James, knew that I absolutely loved Bruce Springsteen and Bruce Springsteen was staying in the same hotel. My son saw Bruce and kindly got Bruce's autograph for me and came up and said, yeah, I've got his autograph. And I felt like saying, well, I didn't want his autograph. I wanted a raunchy night with Bruce Springsteen. Forget the autograph.
Yeah, that's harder to secure, I believe. Let's talk then a little bit about, well, not rock and roll, but certainly showbiz and your own, and it was a heck of a break, your big break in 1975, is that
right? Yes, that's right, yeah.
Opportunity Knocks. In those days, those of us who remember the clapometer, well, it nearly clapped off the screen when you came on. What was that experience like?
I got mixed feelings about it, really, because I was very gullible at that time. I was very green. And because of my accent, they gave me this rubbishy old set, this comfy old armchair.
Yeah, there's a sort of teapot and stuff,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, a teapot very with a knitted tea cosy on it. And just made me look really sort of folksy. Well, I didn't necessarily want to look like that. But because of my accent, you get pigeonholed.
Were you nervous?
Then, oh, I was petrified. I didn't even think that, well, it's recorded. You know, if it's a disaster, we can do it again. All I realised was that I was on telly. And the cameras had a big red glass thing, like a giant OXO cube on the top. And that came on, that lit up, and you knew you were on. And I started to recite, I Wish I Looked After My Teeth. And my heart was pounding so fast, I thought, this must show on the screen. You know, I must be shaking in my seat because I was really scared. But I got through it and I won.
So millions of people were watching. It was clear that you had something that people enjoyed. You were highly entertaining, you were distinctive and you were talented. What did you want for yourself at that point? What was your plan?
I didn't have a plan at all. I thought, they know best. I knew I loved writing my kind of material. I knew I loved performing it. I was terrified. It always terrified me, but I wanted to do it. You know, you sort of go into that kind of environment, a television environment, and think, well, they know best what's best for me.
And did they know best?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I was very sort of categorised as some sort of rustic idiot, you know, leaning over a five-barred gate saying, who are? And I went along with it to a certain extent. Purely financially, it was ecstasy time because I had money. I was able to buy a house. I bought a little house which cost £11,500, a little semi-detached house. And, you know, that was beyond my wildest dreams. I bought an MGB GT, the sports car of my dreams. So that was fantastic. On the other hand, I felt like I'd lost control.
Time for some more music, Pam Ayres. Then tell me about your next one. What are we going to hear?
My next choice is Tina Turner. I absolutely love Tina Turner for all sorts of reasons. She overcame an absolutely ghastly start. I love her for her energy, for her sexiness and for all the wonderful entertainment she's given us. And also this song reminds me of the work I've done in Australia. I did 12 tours of Australia. They gave me a wonderful welcome. I first became aware of this song in 1993 when this was the Australian Rugby League promo song, and it was on all the tellies, and it was so exciting. You know, you were watching the telly and you'd see all these gorgeous men, these great big chunky men come on, and Tina Turner singing this. Oh, it was fantastic. You're simply the best, better than all the rest, better than
the best, Tina Turner. I've been thinking, because I knew I was going to speak to you, about when we hear poetry on that grand scale, as you say, you know, when you first came onto TV, it was people in their millions that were watching and then people in their thousands wanted to come and see you. And my thoughts were immediately drawn to the very recent tragedy in Manchester, where there was the arena bombing. And in the days and weeks after it, there was one very extraordinary thing that happened. I don't know if you saw it on TV, but it was on all the news bulletins. And it was when the Manchester poet Tony Walsh stood and read a poem that he had made in solidarity and in some respects in defiance of what had happened to that great city. This is the place, it was called. And it was very interesting to see people enraptured and enlivened by poetry who maybe had never had any cause to enjoy poetry before. Did you see that? And what occurred to you as a poet?
I did see it. And I think you can distill the words down to the kernel of what you want to say, and I think that's what he did. And that's the joy of poetry, that you can cut away all the surplus and distill it and get to the heart of it. It's a process of distillation, of cutting away the rubbish and just choosing the right words in the right order to communicate with people, particularly at times of grief and sorrow and joy as well.
Let's have some more music, Pam Ayres. It's time for your seventh. What are we going to hear?
This is one of my favourite songs in the whole world. I think it's one of the most romantic songs ever. And it's sung by Finbar Fury of the Furies. I met the Furies, my husband Dudley, when I first met him. And subsequently, he was touring all sorts of enormous entertainers like Shirley Bassey, Nana Mouskouri, Fats Domino, all sorts of really well-known people in the Albert Hall. And he also seemed to have a niche touring the Irish groups, the Dubliners and the Chieftains and the Furies. And so the Furies came to our house a few times when my children were little, and they were lovely. And they gave me a banjo. And I love it. It's a genuine Furies banjo, but sadly, I have never been able to pluck it as eloquently as this.
When first I saw the love light in your eye, I thought the world held not but joy for me. And even though we've drifted far apart, I never dream but what I dream of thee.
The Fury Brothers and Davy Arthur and When You Were Sweet 16. You mentioned Dudley there. He went on to be your agent, and you have two sons together now grown up with families of their own. When they were younger and you were writing, how on earth did you manage that? How did you manage to get the peace and quiet and the time that it takes with a young family?
Well, I had a nanny. I sort of regret that now. Now I've got grandchildren and I get such joy from seeing them develop and how they learn to talk and how they start clawing their way around the sofa and all that. I'm not sure I concentrated on that as much. I'm not sure I observed that as much with my own children. I loved them dearly and I was always at home, but I felt very driven to write. I just felt full of ideas and things to write about and I had to get it down. I'm not saying I wasn't a good mum. I hope I was a good mum, but there is that regret, and I think that's true of a lot of working mothers.
And you're still obviously highly productive and still working. Do you see an end to it, or will you always have to write and want to be published?
I've always written, ever since I was at school and I discovered writing and I discovered that I could knock up a story and loved it. I don't imagine that I would ever lose that inclination. I may lose the ability if I go senile, but it's been so much a part of me for all my life. I can't imagine not always having the antenna out, just looking for ideas.
How do you view the prospect of being sent alone to an island? How are you with your own company?
Quite good. I've always been fairly self-contained, but to the exclusion of everybody else, that's a very different, very serious thing. I could do it, but I'd be glad to scuttle home if somebody came and rescued me.
Tell me about your final piece of music then, Pam Ayres. What are we going to hear?
This is a piece from Pagliacci. And the reason I've chosen it is because my husband Dudley is involved with an organisation called Arts in Rural Gloucestershire, and it also works in other counties as well. And it's supported by the Arts Council. And it brings entertainment of a very high standard. They have to be screened into the village halls. And Dudley's organised lots of these performances in our village hall. And I go along as the mince pie and sausage roll operative. And we've had fantastic acts. One of the acts we had was called the Opera Dudes, and they did opera in a very light way and did nice pieces from the famous operas. And at one point in the performance, they sang this, and everybody was sitting round their tables, and they had bottles of wine and things to eat, and they were chatting with their neighbours, and they only had to walk home just down the road at the end of the evening. And I just thought, what a lovely idea it is. And they sang this song, and it pinned us to the wall.
Vesti la Luba from Pagliacci by Leon Cavallo, performed there by Luciano Pavarotti with the Vienna Volksoper Orchestra conducted by Leone Megera. It's time for me to give you some things now, Pam Mears.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm going to give you some books, The Complete Works of Shakespeare and the Bible, and one other book to go with those two. What's it going to be?
Well, to cheer me up in my isolation, I would like Frank Muir's book. It's quite old. It's called The Oxford Book of Humorous Prose, and it's excerpts of funny writers all down the centuries, from Chaucer right up to the present day. And there's S.J. Perelman and all the authors that I love. And so you can just choose the one that matches your mood. So that one, please.
We will give you that. You're allowed a little luxury, or indeed a big one. What will yours be?
Well, I don't know if I'd be able to get away with this, but mosquitoes like me. I thought in my old age I'd get stringy and tough, but they still like me just as much. So I wondered if I could have a set. I may not be able to. I'm being a bit cheeky. I'd like a tube of antihistamine cream, a mosquito net, and a great big fly swatter as big as a tennis racket.
You are really straining at the boundaries of what I'm allowed. Shall we say that I give you a medicine cabinet that happens to be full of things that repel mosquitoes? Whatever is in there, you may use.
Yes, but can I get in the fly swatter as big as a tennis racket?
Well, we'll have to see if it's in there.
I'll have the medicine cabinet, okay, because I might, some terrible injury might befall me,
right,
and I'd be able to cope.
OK, it's yours. And which of these 8 discs, carefully chosen, would you save?
That's really tough. I would like to choose Finbar Fury's Singing Sweet 16, because it will remind me of my wild, well, not so wild, youth and the joys of romance.
It's yours. Pam Ayers, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you. I have loved it.
Hi, I really hope you enjoyed that interview with Pam Ayers. There are many Desert Island Discs featuring poets including Lem Cisse, Liz Lockhead, Imtiaz Darker and John Agard, to name just a few of them. All are available to download. You'll also have heard Pam refer to her love of Bruce Springsteen. Well, he was my guest back in December of 2016. In 1984, you released what remains, in spite of all your other huge successes, your most successful selling album, Born in the USA, and that iconic image on the cover, the Annie Leibovitz photograph. You said at the time, in the end, that picture was chosen because my ass looked better than the picture of my face, which always makes me smile. But it tells tales of ordinary Americans, of people just grinding out their jobs, of trying to make difficult relationships work, of dealing with being short of money. I mean, that is still what you write about, and yet the further away you have moved from that in your life, how easy is it to always connect when you go to that place of writing with the ordinary lives of everyday Americans?
Well, you know, you have all of your experience to draw from all the time. And I think that the performers that we feel are wrestling with something significant are the performers that hold our attention. So a lot of my work is drawn from the period in my life where I'm trying to go back and make sense of things that at the time were unfathomable and uncontextualizable. And that continues to this day. I constantly go back and I put my father's clothes on and I walk out on stage and I present some version of him and myself at night to my audience. And why am I doing that? Well, I'm trying to find the piece of it that would lead to a certain sort of transcendence over those circumstances that I grew up in. So these are all things I'm working out on stage at night and why people come to see us.
It's clearly worked professionally. Has it worked personally?
Well, generally doesn't work as well personally as professionally. At some point you have to, you know, you address these things and you let a certain amount of them go, and of course you move on, but you're always called back to those moments. And while I don't live in them anymore, I do occasionally revisit them.
I know you didn't have a beer till you were 22. Steve Van Sant says you are the only person he has ever known who has never, ever taken drugs. You operate your band setup in a kind of benign dictatorship. It seems that the control that you've been able to exert personally has also been a very significant part of that. You exerted just untypical in your industry control over how you've behaved.
Yeah, I'm sure too much at times, but I come from a chaotic childhood, I felt. And so what I was interested in doing was creating some order and a safe environment for myself, because my childhood felt very unsafe, and a structure where I can express myself freely and grow into a man, you know.
Bruce Springsteen talking to me back in December 2016. Well, we're now going to take a short summer break, and whilst we're dusting the deck chairs and getting the island ready for our autumn castaways, we've selected some classic Desert Island Discs that we'll be putting out as weekly podcasts for you. I hope you enjoy them.
This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Dan Saladino. If you enjoyed that programme, you might also enjoy The Food Programme, where each week we bring you stories from around the UK and around the world. Stories of people and places, cooking and culture, politics and pleasure. There are hundreds of episodes available, and it's easy to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.